I'm Nancy Hayes from EDUCAUSE, and I would like to introduce Kent Wada of UCLA, and he will be speaking on an institutional framework for privacy in higher education. And I'd like to particularly thank the online audience. They will have the opportunity to share questions, and if there's time for questions, because Kent has a lot to cover this morning. So welcome, and I hope that you enjoy the talk.
Thanks, Nancy. So yes, as usual, my biggest trouble was actually trying to pare back the number of slides I was going to present this morning, and was busy doing that up until about 45 minutes ago. So let me start with a little video. Some of you have probably seen this, and hopefully you'll still enjoy it if you have, but if you haven't, I think you'll find this a little amusing.
Pizza Palace, is this Mr. Kelly?
Yes.
Thank you for calling again, sir. I share your national identification number as 610-204-999-8-45-54610, is that correct?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. I see you live at 736 Montrose Court, but you're calling from your cell phone. Are you at home?
I'm just leaving work, but I'm...
Oh, we can deliver to Bob's Auto Supply.
No, I'm on my way home. How do you know all this stuff?
We just got wired into the system, sir.
Oh, well, I'd like to order a couple of your double meat special pizzas.
Sure thing. There'll be a new $20 charge for those, sir.
What do you mean?
Sir, the system shows me that your medical records indicate that you have high blood pressure and extremely high cholesterol. The total is $67 even.
$67?
Well, that includes the delivery surcharge of $15 to cover the added risk to our driver of traveling through an orange zone.
I live in an orange zone?
Now you do. Looks like there was another robbery on Montrose yesterday.
But I want double meat.
Well, I'm sure you can afford the $67 then. You just bought those tickets to Hawaii. They weren't cheap, eh? Oh, but I see you checked out the budget beach bum at the library last week.
I'll get the Sprout subs.
Good choice, sir. Gotta watch that waist if you're hitting the beach, eh? 42 inches. Wow.
That's how much?
Just between you and me, there's a $3 off coupon in this month's Total Men's Fitness magazine. Your wife, Betty, subscribes to that, right? Anyhow, clip that and it's $19.99 even. Whoa, looks like you maxed out on all your credit cards. Bring cash, okay?
Want to stop this from happening?
Okay, so that's a little bit cute and probably a little bit far-fetched, but not that far-fetched. You know, when we think typically about privacy matters and the data that people keep on us and concerns about the data that companies have on us, we're usually thinking about companies like Google and Facebook and maybe Apple and Microsoft, not about our pizza companies. It's a little bit unclear why Pizza Palace would want to know this much about us, but no doubt they have a good reason for doing so. The amount of data that you just saw in that little ACLU video clip is really quite amazing. All of the things that they have access to about you. But if we turn this around, if we flip this around and think about what it is our institutions, our universities and colleges have, we have all of this data as well about our students, about our faculty, about our staff, our patients, our volunteers, our donors, our basketball fans, all of that kind of stuff. We have tons of data on people that are relevant to us. In addition, we have a ton more data about people. All of our student records, human subjects, research data. We have all sorts of email systems that email is stored in. We have disabilities disclosures. We have tons of stuff about people. And our obligation to protect all of that, of course, is a big deal to us. Interestingly, though, we have not actually really spent a lot of time correlating this data, unlike Pizza Palace and like some of these other companies like Google and Facebook, which are taking data about people and correlating it into a profile about people, about individuals. We have not really been doing very much about that. This op-ed piece that appeared in the Chronicle a couple of years ago was penned by a police officer at one of the CSU campuses, California State University campuses, and he was arguing that we have an obligation to try and prevent more tragedies from happening at our institutions that are related to students, and the way to do that would be to mine the data that we have about our students. So that means not just looking at the traditional patterns of behavior that we might see from falling grades, from whether our students are visiting our student health centers, that kind of thing, but also mining all data we have about our students. So if we run our students' email systems, we should actually be looking at their email and seeing if there are, if we can detect patterns that might give us, you know, a little bit of insight as to whether or not a student is troubled, and therefore might we can do some kind of intervention and prevent another tragedy from happening. That's a laudable goal. Obviously, we want to, you know, protect people, save lives. That's a really good thing. But there is certainly a creepiness factor involved when you think about looking at people's email, if nothing else. The other place where we've really been starting to look at correlating data is in the online learning space. not necessarily just the online learning space, but particularly in the online learning spaces, when we think about how we look at student success and student outcomes. You know, what are the factors that lead to students' success in their academic careers? And in the online space, you could think of, you know, you could ask all sorts of questions. You could ask your, ask yourself, ask your institution, is there some correlation between, you know, how effective some student is at typing and whether or not they graduate on time, something like that. There's nothing to stop us from keylogging and measuring keystrokes and how effective people are at typing. I'm not sure that we'd want to do that, but we certainly can do that. And that's, of course, one of the, my favorite things to say in the policy realm is just because you can doesn't mean you should. And you know, that's sort of the premise of this entire talk, that as we increase our abilities to do things, we really need to think hard about putting constraints around them and coming to some agreement about what those constraints are. One of the well, as not surprising to anyone, the commercial sector, the private sector, is really good at building profiles about people. There was a great article in the New York Times last year, I think it was February of last year, talking about this, and they used Target as an example. Target, the corporation, was targeting their customer base, that portion of their customer base that they thought was pregnant. And the reason why they were targeting pregnant women was because that's one of the few times in your life where you might have a chance of influencing or changing people's buying behaviors. Apparently, most of us have certain patterns of buying that are ingrained in us. So you might go to Target to buy, you know, a certain set of products. Target might sell a whole bunch of other things that you buy elsewhere, either out of brand loyalty or out of habit or convenience or what have you, but you simply don't buy it at Target, and Target wanted to change that. So what do? Well, you intervene at a time when you are likely most susceptible to changing things in your life, and that apparently one of those times is when you're pregnant because you're tired, you're stressed, you know, convenience rules everything else. And so they were trying to identify across their tens of millions of customers what that, you know, what that community of pregnant women was. So they hired someone to do number crunching who came up with something like 25 different factors. And if they analyze those 25 different factors across their millions and millions of customers, they could identify with pretty good accuracy which one of their customers were pregnant. And there was proof in the pudding of this when, so the story goes, a father, I think it was in a Minnesota store, walked in very upset that his daughter, his teenage daughter in high school, had started receiving these targeted ads from Target about, you know, products that would be useful to pregnant women. And he was saying, how could you, you know, what do you do trying to get my daughter pregnant? Well, of course, it turned out she was pregnant. It's just he didn't know it, and Target did. And so they've become a little bit savvier since then. They've stopped just sending targeted ads about things that are useful to you as a pregnant woman. They embedded in, you know, a bunch of other ads that have nothing to do with pregnancy, so it doesn't look like you're being targeted, and yet you are. You know, this is not obvious at all, but if you think, or if you look at what Target knows about you, the data on the elements on the left-hand column are things that they collect about you directly. The things in the right-hand column are data that they buy, that's pretty easy to buy from third parties. And you know, across all of this data that they have about their customers, they can do an enormous amount of data mining and profiling. Just think what we could do as, you know, colleges and universities, as higher education, if we knew this much about our donors or about our patients, about anything. The, you know, the mind boggles at what it is we could start trying to look at. So just thinking about what I've been talking about in terms of privacy out of the pizza video, the ACLU pizza video, I've been talking about privacy in two different ways. One is sort of the civil liberty, the value of privacy to society. That's when you think about Big Brother, about surveillance, the kinds of disclosures we've been hearing about from Edward Snowden, about what the NSA is doing in terms of surveillance. The other form of privacy is about protecting data about people. And so that's really typically, you know, we can think of it as compliance. That's protecting information about people. We know it as FERPA. We know it as HIPAA. We think about it in terms of PCI DSS to protect credit card data that we have, that kind of thing. So they're both privacy. They're both forms of privacy. One is protecting people from surveillance. One is protecting people by protecting data about them. But they're not exactly the same thing. And I'm just going to change the terms a little bit to reflect some terminology that's coming out of some thinking that we've been doing at the University of California and calling them autonomy privacy and information privacy. So here are some definitions. You may or may not, you know, agree exactly with the wording that we have here, but roughly speaking, autonomy privacy, again, is about surveillance and protection from surveillance. Information privacy is about protecting information about people. And one of the things that occurred to me actually last night is that traditionally when we're thinking about these two types of privacy, information privacy has really been the traditional realm of the privacy officer. Because again, we're talking about compliance. We're talking about making sure we don't have breaches. Suffering breaches, heaven knows. If you had one before, you don't want another one. If you've never had one, you don't want to have one in the first place. Whereas the autonomy privacy side, the worries, the concerns that we have as individuals are concerns we have as individuals. What's Google doing with all of our data? What do they know about us? What can they infer from us? What, you know, ads do they serve? What ads don't they serve to us because they think they know something about us? And I guess what I'm arguing today is that, in fact, that those two forms of privacy are now becoming really relevant to the institution, so that the traditional realm of the privacy officer for us needs to encompass both forms. So let me just take a second to make a pitch for Data Privacy Month, which is January and February next year, spanning January and February next year. If you just go to educause.edu/DPM, you can find out all about the activities that Educause is partnering with other organizations to put on during Data Privacy Month. And if you're doing anything, by all means, please add that to the list. So with that, let me give you a little bit more context about privacy. First of all, a soundbite. Privacy is always going to be about people. Whether it's about protecting people directly from observation, that's again the surveillance, or whether it's about protecting people by protecting information about them from unauthorized disclosures, we're talking about people. So again, autonomy privacy and information privacy. So we add to that mix IT security, which is about protecting our infrastructure, protecting our computers and our networks. And to that, I'll add the last piece, which is information security, which protects all information. So you'll see that what privacy and security actually overlap in that middle box of information. Privacy protects only that part of information that's about people. Information security protects all information. And you can think of any number of examples where we have confidential or sensitive information that's not about people. Intellectual property, say a list of labs that we have on our campuses where controlled substances are used for research purposes, or computer security configuration information that if we're, you know, if we let that out there, that's a blueprint for how to attack our systems. So information security, again, protects all of this kind of information, doesn't matter whether it's about people or not, whereas privacy, information privacy is really, again, the subset, protecting the subset of information that's about people. Little note, I put a little asterisk beside IT security just to say that's the only place you see IT in this diagram. Not to say that IT security is an easy problem or easy to accomplish well, but just to say that privacy and security, for that information security for that matter, are concepts that go far beyond technology, even though technology plays such a large role in these things. So another little interesting outcome out of all of this work is that typically we think of it, you know, it's a zero-sum game between privacy and security, that if you have more of one, then you have to have less of the other. As it turns out, that might be true. In some cases, that's true. But it also can be an argument of privacy versus privacy. where if you give a little bit more autonomy privacy, you have to take a little information privacy away. So it's not quite as simple as privacy versus security. If you think about the ways we protect data, you know, we protect our patient data or protect our student records, often it's about watching what people are doing. Who's accessing those records? For what reason? You know, logging what times they did that, what they accessed, watching what people are doing. That's actually a sort of impinging on the autonomy privacy. So as I said, if you look at these two forms of privacy, one has been really the traditional realm of the privacy officer for our institutions or a privacy function. The other has really been something that we worry about individuals by and large. And I would argue now that what we're looking at as institutions is having to look at both forms of privacy because they're both important to us. And that implies a certain set of changes. The classic argument for why we value autonomy privacy in our institutions is about academic freedom, although there are other reasons as well. This particular diagram, I've shown it before, so some of you may have seen it or have seen it otherwise, is an architectural diagram of something called the Panopticon. It's the design of a prison, a circular prison, and here's a real-life Panopticon, I think, in Illinois. And as you can see, it's a circle. All of the prisoners are on view from the central tower where the guards are, but the prisoners can't actually see into the central tower, so they don't know at any given moment if they're actually being observed or not. You know, that's actually an interesting thing. You don't know if you're being watched, but the very fact that you might be watched, you might be being watched at any given time, changes your behavior, which of course is the whole point of the design of this prison, that it actually exerts an effect. Oops, geez, excuse me, I'm losing my balance here. Not enough coffee, actually no coffee yet this morning. It actually exerts an effect on your behavior just by thinking that someone might be watching you. And of course, that's exactly what we're trying to protect against in terms of academic freedom for our faculty. This is just some really nice words that were written for us by Chris Hufnagel, now at the Berkeley Law and Technology Center, I guess. I think that's the right name. Speaking to the link between academic and intellectual freedoms and how privacy, in particular autonomy privacy, is an underpinning of this value that's so fundamental to the missions of our institutions of higher education. So again, that's the classic argument for why autonomy privacy is important to us, but there are other reasons too. UCLA uses this, we offer this software called Front Door Software. It's anti-theft software for laptops. You can turn it on, it tries to track. It's sort of like Find My iPhone. You know, if you lose your iPhone or if your iPhone is stolen, probably many of your institutions have that as well. Easy, it's due diligence, it makes us, you know, it's part of being good stewards of our assets, of our resources. But it can also be misused. This is a pretty well-known case that happened a couple of years ago. This is a picture of a young man in his bedroom that was taken by this kind of software, in fact. He was part of the Lower Merion School District, and I think it's just outside of Philadelphia, a pretty affluent area where they issue laptops to their students. And again, they, like many of us, put on anti-theft software so that if their laptops are lost or stolen, they can turn on the software and hopefully locate it again. Well, some of the school officials apparently weren't really clear on the concept of when they can turn that software on or when they should. Again, just because you can doesn't mean you should. And they were busy turning it on all the time, even when the laptops weren't lost or stolen, snapping 56,000 photos, actually it was something like 66,000 photos of students wherever their laptops happened to be in this particular case in this young man's bedroom. He found out about this and brought a lawsuit against the school district, which, by the way, I'm told is where Kobe Bryant grew up and was very successful in basketball in high school. But he found out about this when one of the school administrators confronted him at school one day and said, you are doing drugs, you know, you're taking drugs, and showed him a photo of him in his bedroom, apparently taking drugs. And he said, no, I'm eating a lollipop or candy or something like that, you know. But The point is, why on earth are you showing me a picture of me in my bedroom that you took without me knowing about it through this laptop using this software when the laptop wasn't stolen or lost? And, you know, regardless of what we might think or what any of you might think individually about the, you know, the right balance between privacy and security, I think pretty much we can all agree the bedroom is a place which is pretty private, and taking pictures of people without them knowing in their bedrooms is probably a bad thing, which is why, in terms of deploying front door software at UCLA, we're actually putting together what we're calling a code of conduct. You know, what makes sense? When do we engage this kind of software? Under what circumstances? Who can authorize this? Who gets to look at the data? That kind of thing. So here's another kind of privacy that is related to autonomy privacy in terms of research. This is a project called HyperCities. If you go to hypercities.com, it's absolutely fascinating. You can watch, you can put overlay all sorts of things on a time, sort of a timeline-based view of cities. But in this particular case, they were looking at Egypt in early 2011 during the revolution there. And what they were doing in this particular case was capturing the Twitter stream that was happening. And both for our research purposes, they were archiving the Twitter stream, but also trying to see in real time over a few weeks if they could capture the sort of a sense of the national mood just watching the tweets that were happening. Really interesting stuff. Again, you can go see it yourself. But you know, it's not like there were tens of millions of tweeters in Egypt at that time, and there was a real worry that by pinpointing accurately the location of where these tweeters were at the time that they tweeted, that we could be literally painting targets on people's backs. And so there was a decision that was made to expand, you know, to make the tweeters' locations a little bit fuzzy, do some geographic de-identification, making it maybe a little bit less useful for research purposes, a little bit less accurate, but at the same time hopefully making it much less likely that people would suffer grievous harm because of research that we were engaged in. So some of you may have heard or seen of a documentary film that came out quite recently called Terms and Conditions May Apply. This is really worth watching. Again, you may or may not agree with it, but it's good information. I'm going to show you a little trailer.
Doing a privacy change for 350 million users,
yeah,
is a really, you know, it's not a not the type painful, of thing, yeah, that a lot of companies would do. We decided that these would be the social norms now, and we just went for it.
Google is effectively a $500 a year service because that's the value of the data that you're providing.
If they use 10% of that data, they're going to be the most valuable company ever.
Companies that you've never heard of claim to have about 1,500 points of data on the average American citizen.
Is it hard to go through it and actually find specific details about a person?
No, that's super easy. Within a couple of minutes, you can figure out what people voted for, what psychological problems they have, what parties they've been to.
They're saying it's because I agreed to the latest terms and conditions on iTunes.
No one has read the terms and conditions. No one in the world!
To the extent there have been contract decisions, they've held that these terms and conditions are valid.
And what if your phone came with these long terms and conditions that, well, if you use the phone, the government can wiretap you? That would be insane. But that's the kind of world we're living in.
Anything that's been digitized is not private. And that is terrifying.
For the government to get information from a Google or a Facebook is a lot easier than the government doing it itself and putting a wiretap on our phones.
You have to put these powers into somebody's hands.
Like social networks in recent times.
If you have something that you don't want anyone to know, maybe you shouldn't be doing it in the first place.
Well, that's always what scared me was, if there's some sort of automated system that just red flags you based on the search term.
You can see that surveillance measures are being used to silence protests before they even happen.
Boom, NYPD SWAT, bulletproof vests on, their guns drawn.
I was like, are you being serious? Are you actually holding me because of a tweet?
So we were locked away in Lewisham Police Station for 25 hours.
All these powerful institutions, they're not subject to the same invasions of privacy as the rest of us are.
So far, the population seems fine with it. If they weren't, they know who to call.
So I think it's Marcos Vieira at the University of South Carolina who's going to be doing a couple of screenings of this together with panel discussions afterwards during Data Privacy Month. We're going to be doing that at UCLA as well. It is really an interesting thing to watch, as I say, independent of whether you agree with some of this or not. And by the way, he said, well, if you don't like this, you know where to call. Well, actually, I don't know where to call. Where do you call if you want to complain about, you know, invasion of privacy rights? So let's get back to looking at it from an institution's point of view. We have a set of things that are much broader, I think, that are driving us towards really thinking about autonomy, privacy, and how we protect that. One is the expectations of individuals. You know, we're all now savvy, familiar experts with iPhones and with smartphones and our Android phones. And we bring that to the table. We expect to be able to do certain things and blur our lives, our personal and our professional lives. And it's not the fact necessarily that it's a personal device that we're using. It's the fact that we're mingling, commingling university data with personal data. That's really the issue, because how we choose to protect things and how the institution chooses to protect its data may not match. We may have two different expectations, and that's where the rub comes in, of course, because we would like to make sure that our data as institutions are protected at a certain level, and if not, something happens, we want the right to be able to go in and take a look at what happens, which is a direct affront to the autonomy, privacy of the individual. The second thing there, we're increasingly, as higher education, partnering with external vendors, whether it's Google, whether it's Microsoft, whether it's Dropbox, the Net Plus Box offering that Internet 2 is offering. And these companies also have different sets of expectations. Autonomy, privacy is probably not one of them, not one of the expectations that they value. And so again, we have a set of tensions between what our expectations are and what their expectations are, and yet we need to be partners. We just saw about the risk of government surveillance activity. Inherently, that's neither good nor bad. You may believe, you know, one side or another, whether this is a good thing or a bad thing, but simply from the point of view of the institution, it's a factor that you need to consider when you engage in, say, outsourcing. So, for example, UCLA is about to, next month at its privacy board meeting, think about, you know, we're about to deploy or thinking about deploying. We're almost at the point of deploying both Microsoft Office 365 and Google Apps for our faculty and staff. But we're going to have one more conversation specifically from the privacy aspect to, now that we actually know more about what's happening with the NSA since June, you know, is this something we really want to do? When we know by outsourcing all of our intellectual property, the researchers' discussions, all of our confidential information will be swept up by the NSA and probably archived there forever. You know, is that a reasonable thing? It may be, it may not be. It's only one factor. It's not necessarily the determining factor, but it's a conversation we feel like we need to have. It's not like that legal risk wasn't always there. It's always been there. It's just now it has a shape, a concrete shape to it, a concrete name to it, a concrete face to it. So when you look at all of these things, there are a huge number of things that as institutions we have to take into consideration. They're all factors that we balance, some more highly, some not as highly, but we need some way to think about how do you balance privacy versus research and innovation, for example. If you give too much privacy right, if you will, or afford too much autonomy privacy, that can really create problems in terms of research and innovation. And all of these things, regardless of what they are things that are in tension with one another that somehow impact privacy and vice versa. And so my second statement, privacy, you know, first one being privacy is always about people. Second one is privacy is always going to be a balancing act. It's one value, typically, one obligation that we have as institutions amongst a whole constellation of other obligations and values that we have to consider in decisions. So how do we do that? That's remarkably different in many respects, primarily because we're comparing apples and oranges. You know, some of these things, like autonomy, privacy, is a value of society. It's not something concrete, whereas suffering a breach, if we don't do information privacy right and we have a breach, there's a real concrete weight to that, a real concrete consequence, whether it's litigation or reputational or what have you. And so again, what I'm about to describe here very briefly is work that's coming out of the University of California. I'm hoping that we'll be able to release the full report soon. But there's sort of three legs here. Framework, I think, that helps you think about privacy, privacy governance, a way of making decisions, and a privacy official. That's sort of the operational point for making things happen at your institution. Plus, of course, the definitions that I gave that talk about the difference between or the two forms of privacy and how privacy differs from information security. So very briefly, if you think about the privacy, or if you look at the privacy framework, there are three components to it. There's a statement of privacy values. What this is very simple. It's just some language that says privacy is important to the University of California. It's important to UCLA. Surprisingly, we don't say that anywhere else. We embed it and imply it in many of our policies, but we've never actually come out and said that. So that's what the statement of privacy values does. It simply says privacy of both forms, both autonomy privacy and information privacy, is important to the institution. The other thing it says, though, is that it's merely one factor. Again, it's one of many different obligations and values that we have, and it's neither inherently more important or less important than any of those other factors. So the second thing, the privacy principles you'll be very familiar with. They're based on the OECD privacy principles or the Federal Trade Commission's Fair Information Practices principles that underlie HIPAA and FERPA and other legislation like that. They're a way of helping to guide decision making. There are principles such as transparency, you know, making sure that when you decide what it is you're going to do, you let people know what that is and you don't deviate from it. That's what a privacy policy or privacy notice is supposed to do, and frequently, like that terms and conditions may apply thing says, most of the terms and conditions that we agree to are more or less meaningless because they say, here's what we do today, but we're free to change it at any time and we don't have to even tell you about it. The balancing process is just a generic process that allows you to, it's a tool that can be used by the governing entity, whatever that is, to help adjudicate between these legitimate needs that may butt heads. So, for example, you have a situation where the security officer is asserting a security need. I need to do this, but it's going to impinge on autonomy privacy. Who's to say which is more important for the institution? You know, someone has to come to that decision. In some of your institutions, it'll be simply a person. In others, you may have a policy that guides you. But there are some strategic things, like, for example, does your institution want to outsource its email to Google or to Microsoft Office 365? That needs to be taken on, I'd say, at a much higher level because that's has a strategic implication. It's not just about the surveillance of the communication between our administrators and our faculty. It could also be about our foreign students in particular who might be surveilled. I mean, this is actually pretty well known that email from Google is again being swept up, and you know, UCLA has already outsourced its undergraduate student email to Google, like many of your institutions. What implications does that have? You know, and how do you even discuss that? The privacy official is really the privacy officer or someone who fulfills that role. But in some ways, just by naming someone to be a privacy official is a way of making privacy visible. And it's also a way of making sure that people understand that there's a difference between privacy and security. You know, before all of this work that I was engaged in and many of my colleagues, some of whom are in the room, engaged in at the University of California, we very hard pressed to say what the difference between privacy and security really was, let alone that there were two entirely different forms of privacy. And so just by naming a privacy official of some sort, whether it's a privacy officer or something else, you are making it clear there is a distinction there. So I'm going to add one other thing to this privacy framework that I think helps us understand clearly, even though it may seem obvious, helps us think more clearly about why we're suffering or seeing these tensions today that are ever increasing. And it's based on our missions. I'm going to make an assertion here. This is an argument. You may or may not agree with it. But I'm going to say that information security and information privacy is important to us because they're typically their compliance needs. But if you do the job right, if you do the compliance job right, life goes on the way you want it to. if you do the job wrong, if there's a failure, if there's a breach, suddenly all sorts of things grind to a halt. Your attorneys get involved, money gets spent, people's time and attention gets diverted, things get disabled. Your mission is somehow slowed down. On the other hand, autonomy privacy, which, as I said, if you buy the argument that it's an underpinning of academic freedom, is a value that directly enables our faculty to serve the mission of the university. And so it enables the missions of teaching and research. Both of these things are important to us. I'm not going to make a judgment about what's more important. I want to make the distinction, though, that they're important to us for different reasons. One is, you know, the information security and privacy, trying to avoid breaches, that kind of thing, is critical to us. We don't want to have them because they create problems for us. Whereas on the strategic side, it allows us to grow as an institution, to flourish, to do better as an institution. They are both really important to us, but for completely different reasons. And the reason why they're different, or they're different or important in different ways to us, is because of the way our mission is set up. And so if you think about the fact that our mission is about teaching and research, that's why we would say autonomy privacy is important to us. But if you do the same analysis for these other entities, you know, make any list you can or any list you want, the missions of these entities are going to be different than our institutions. The mission of me as an individual, I'm not actually sure what my personal mission is, but maybe it's life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, is different than the mission of teaching and research. That's also going to be true of Google and Dropbox. I mean, certainly the mission of Google is not going to be to really preserve autonomy privacy. In fact, quite the opposite, because it actually disables their mission of being able to serve up ads and make money. With Dropbox, it may turn out that information privacy and information security is strategic as opposed to critically operational, because they're all about storage. If they fail at that, then their entire company's mission, their entire reason for being, fails as well. So this analysis about what's important to you, whether it's critically important to you because operationally or institutionally strategic, I think is a way of explaining why we're seeing this kind of these tensions that we're seeing, whether it's in the BYOD space, whether it's in partnering with external vendors, whether it's in thinking about the government activities that we're seeing and what implications they have for us. So very briefly, I'm going to give you a couple of parting thoughts, and actually I might actually have time for questions. I'm going to revisit this thing that Eric Schmidt said in that trailer.
If you have something that you don't want anyone to know, maybe you shouldn't be doing it in the first place.
I can't tell you how much that annoys me. I cannot tell you how much that annoys me. It's a form of an argument that I hear all the time. If you have nothing to hide, then what do you have to fear? There's an implication that if you are pro-privacy, that if you respect privacy, you have something to hide. Now, sometimes that's actually true, and I would say for entirely legitimate reasons. What if you're someone who's being stalked? You know, what if you have some illness that you don't want to disclose? What, you know, any number of reasons for things that you may not want the whole world to know. But that's not the only reason why you might want to respect privacy. Anonymity is, I think, a really important underpinning of society. It makes for a healthy society. And it has nothing to do with our being able to, you know, actually hiding something shameful or being an implication that you're hiding something illegal or immoral. Far from it. I put a reference down there. Dan Solov, some of you may know of or have heard of, is a privacy law scholar at George Washington University, and I would highly recommend the paper that I've put there, or the book for that matter that you can buy on Amazon, but at least the paper. He takes this argument of, if you have nothing to hide, then what do you have to fear, and just peels it like an onion, the layers of an onion. It's wonderful. Again, you may or may not agree with it, but I think it's really important to read and understand what those arguments are. So let me also say, if you don't agree with what I just said about if you have nothing to hide argument, would it change your mind if you knew that the NSA were, say, recording all of your telephone calls from today forward? You know, would it change your behavior? That's the panopticon effect. Would it put a chill on not just academic freedom, but would it put a chill on you? Would it put a chill on what you tell people, how you say things to people, even who you call? Well, so I have a partial answer to that question.
The National Security Agency had access to all Americans' communications, faxes, phone calls, and their computer communications.
Is there a recording somewhere of every conversation I had with my little nephew in upstate New York? Is it like that? And
it would be everything, yes. It would be everything.
So interestingly, that is from 2009. That is not 2013. We already know everything you said since 2009 has been captured. How does that make you feel? You know, did you ever say anything in any conversation that you've ever had on your cell phone that you would prefer not to be released to the whole world in some ways, or for the government not to hear, for a private sector company not to hear? Well, in fact, it's too late because it's already been done. But is this going to make a difference in your life? Will it change your behavior for today, and then by tomorrow we'll all be comfortable with it again and just won't think about it? And, you know, it is what it is. We can't do anything about it. And that actually leads me to my final thought for today. And that's the quote, very famous quote from Scott McNeely back in 1999. That's 14 years ago now. It was an important quote because, of course, he was at the time CEO of Sun Microsystems, and most of the internet ran on Sun computers at the time. And in a very offhanded way, during an interview about something else, he said, "You have no privacy anyway. Get over it." And I think many people feel that he was very prescient about this. 14 years later, I think many people feel that privacy is dead. I hear that all the time, you know, that it's too late. And even if there was, you know, even if it's not dead, there are such overwhelming things that are going on. How can I even begin? What can I even begin to do to protect myself or to make a change? Well, so here's my answer to that. I might agree that privacy is dead, but only in the sense that the privacy that I know, that what I grew up with, is dead. When I watch my nephews who are college age or just about college age, I don't think privacy is dead. They just think of privacy in a different way. And if you have kids or if you watch, you know, a different generation and what they value, they don't necessarily value privacy in the same way, but I am absolutely convinced they do value privacy. It's just in a different way than than we have. And so I wouldn't say it's dead, precisely just dead in the way that I've thought of it. The other thing to say here, though, is that there are things that I think we need to do as an institution. I've just gone through why I think autonomy privacy is so important to our institutions and will become increasingly important to our institutions. This is really a difficult position to be in because most of the rest of the world appears not to value autonomy privacy. It's not part of their strategic mission. It's not part of what they value. In fact, it sometimes can be actively the opposite. And so we sort of stick out like a sore thumb. How do we continue to preserve what's really going to be important to us? That's hopefully some of the stuff that we're working on, and what I've talked about today is going to help. We obviously don't have all the answers here, but I just do want to say privacy, you know, isn't completely dead. I do think there's a reason for continuing on to think about privacy, and particularly autonomy privacy, and building that into our institutions. So with that, thank you. I think we might actually have some time for questions. Nancy, is that right? 5 minutes? So I guess I can ask both the audience here and the online audience if you have anything. And Nancy has a microphone.
Yes. And there is a question from the online audience. Chris Lee asks, are there standards from the Department of Higher Education we can strive for when implementing privacy policies? And then goes on to say, I realize that this may be a state-by-state or country-by-country answer. If so, what do you do to ensure that your institution is ahead of the curve?
Well, so I guess, you know, we're all familiar with FERPA is going to be the first thing in terms of protecting our student educational records. But beyond that, that's the data protection part of things. Beyond that, I guess what I'd say is we have a set of policies, and some of those policies implement compliance with the law. But what I just talked about a little bit earlier, the privacy principles, I think, are important as well, because they guide us in situations where a policy or a law doesn't directly tell you what to do, when you have discretion, when you have a sandbox that you can play in, and the law sort of defines the hard edges of that sandbox, and you as an institution have to figure out where in that sandbox your stance is, where you want to be. It's the principles that are going to help you guide that decision as an institution. That is probably my best answer.
If anyone else has a question, please use the microphone. I can bring it to you if you need it. So does anyone else have a question for the speaker? There is a microphone right here in the center front.
Good morning. I just want to know if the student, faculty, or employee can choose to opt out when, in your case, UCLA is doing internal research about the behavior, the academic achievement of students, or faculty success. Thank you.
Let's see. I don't know that we're far enough to know that question or have an answer to that question, if we can opt out of, you know, studies about academic success. There is actually, EDUCAUSE is holding a summit next month, bringing together a few dozen people to talk about privacy in academic success, student success systems. And, you know, again, it's a classic thing where we now have the capability to look at data in a way that we couldn't before. Either we didn't have the data, we didn't have the analysis capability, and we have all these new capabilities. We need to concurrently look at, you know, what should we do, as opposed to what can we do now that we can do something new. I don't think we have the answer to that one yet.
Since you mentioned that now we have different technologies to do different things with what we already had in academia, are students or faculty or any stakeholders informed that their data will be used, even if it's for their benefit, and that was not needed before because we didn't have that capability, but now we do? Are they informed that, we're going to see if you're doing okay according to our standards, and we're profiling you to make sure that we can do something good for you?
I hope the answer is, actually, let me put it this way. If I have anything to say about it, yes.
So the students know when they enroll in school and say, we might be using your data to identify if you're a student at risk to
that
do
would
some,
certainly.
I'm just questioning.
That is sort of basic privacy principle number one, is being transparent, as I say. Although you do have to keep in mind, and this is one of the things about research studies, if you know you're being watched, again, you change your behavior. So you often can't tell people that you're being watched, because then it changes the results of your research. But yes, I think in general, I would absolutely want to provide the disclosures up front so people understand what's happening. Nancy.
There is one more question from James Sankar online. What does privacy mean for international research collaboration, recognizing that there are different international laws that make this complex?
Wow. So international collaboration, you're right. It just adds a layer of complexity that to an already complicated situation. Again, I think this is going to go back to coming to a set of agreements up front, so that people understand what those agreements are, and then being transparent about them.
Well, thank you very much. And the time is up, but that was a wonderful talk. Kent, thank you very much for sharing.